Chapter 33, Friday, September 27th through Saturday, November 16th, 1776. Many of the inhabitants are coming to town, and many others who were obliged to fly for their loyalty are coming in daily. New York Mercury newspaper. The autumn passed in a dog-weary haze for me, with much work and little time left to ponder or breathe. Everything was cloaked in gray, oyster gray, charcoal gray, pewter gray, mold gray, storm gray, and ash. Scraps of ash floated through the air for weeks and found their way into everything from the butter to the tea. The rains turned the ash to mud. Frost painted the ground the color of a gravestone. Ashes trapped in ice. I flaked ashy, too. Mama used to rub a salve of bear fat and mint on us as winter approached so our skin would not dry and crack. Was Ruth's skin dry? Did anyone notice? Ashes drifted into the hollow places in my bones and silted up my brain pan. I had the fanciful notion that perhaps we had died in the fire, that we were all lost souls, forbidden to enter heaven. When I had low thoughts like that, Corzine's voice would call from my memory and tell me to join him, to become a rebel. I told that voice to hush. With the ash so thick inside and out, I had few thoughts to spare for that fool. I figured he was dug in with the troops at Fort Washington, which seemed a good place, what with the strong walls and the cannons protecting it. Folks said the British wouldn't attack the fort until spring. The men drilled and patrolled. Sarah and the other soldier wives spent most of their days down at the campground doing the chores for the regiment, washing clothes in big iron pots and cooking whatever could be found to roast or stew. They did some tidying at the Lockton house and kept the officers fed, too. The dirtiest jobs fell to me. Water hauling, wood chopping, and chamber pot emptying. On top of that, Colonel Hawkins claimed me for his errand girl, sending me out with messages for this captain or that sergeant or in search of snuff or hair powder or almonds. He was terrible fond of almonds. By the time the apples were harvested, hundreds of ships crammed with expensive British goods crowded the docks. The price of food doubled and doubled again. This did not affect the Locktons nor the rich loyalist refugees who streamed into the city toting bags of gold. We took delivery of enough potatoes to fill the bin in the cellar and had no trouble buying meat. But regular folks burnt out of their homes, and penniless loyalist refugees on the run from the rebels, they were forced to shelter in Canvas Town, the new name for the burned-over district. They used tent canvas to make huts against the standing chimneys and half-crumbled brick walls. They ate beans and rice when they were lucky and begged on the streets when they were not. One day, I noticed that the plants grown from Mama's seeds had been killed by the frost, the stalks dead on the ground with shriveled paper leaves. A lump of mud stuck in my throat. I had forgotten to care for them. I collected the few seeds left from the flower heads and wrapped them in a scrap of cloth that I laid under the loose board in the pantry where I'd hidden my sliver of lead from the king's statue. As the weather turned colder, Lady Seymour's mind cleared and her body strengthened. She could walk with help and move the crippled arm some, but her mouth still dragged at the corner and her speech was hard to follow. Madam was not entirely pleased that her husband's aunt was mending. I heard her grumble to Lockton that the old biddy would never die, just to spite us. A month or so after the fire, I was setting down a clean pitcher of water in Lady Seymour's bedchamber whilst Madam read the newspaper aloud to her. I thought the lady was dozing, but her eyes snapped open when Madam described how British soldiers had looted the City Hall library. They stole books, ruined paintings, and broke scientifical equipment stored there by the professors of King's College. Lady Seymour made Madam repeat the entire story, then demanded pen and ink and paper, fighting her way out from the blankets with her good arm. Once dressed warmly and settled at the writing table, she composed a strongly worded letter about the library destruction to General Howe, Supreme Commander of the Royal Forces, and called for a glass of brandy and a bowl of soup. After that, it fell to me to walk with Lady Seymour along Wall Street on days when the sun was strong. She hired three seamstresses to sew her a new wardrobe and included a heavy skirt and thick woolen cloak for me in the order. I protested that I could not pay for the clothes, but Lady Seymour simply pointed to the portrait of the yellow-haired man, her husband, on the mantel, and his letters stacked next to it. "We'll not discuss payment again," she said slowly. "Thank you, ma'am," I said. After the pigs had been slaughtered and fresh pork was for sale in the market, another wave of British officers moved in and set up their camp beds in the second floor drawing room. The long dining table was covered end to end with maps. The men would stand over them, chins in their hands, trying to figure out how to finish off the rebels. They were now scheming to finish the war in time for the new year. Battles and skirmishes were fought on the north part of New York Island, though the city was safe. Whilst they plotted Washington's downfall, I dozed in a chair in the hallway in case they needed victuals or a bottle of port. Sleep was a rare and precious thing to me in those days. The next day, I was yawning hard as I trudged up to the tea water pump. The November wind carried the promise of snow, and I was glad for the new cloak Lady Seymour had given me. Soon I would need rags to wrap round my hands. My muddled head did not register the great hullabaloo at first, but then my ears awoke. Folks were shouting and hurrying toward the Greenwich Road where it dumped out onto the Commons. I was not sure what the race was for, but I lifted my skirts and joined along with it. "They got 'em!" cheered a red-faced man, throwing both of his arms into the air. "They got 'em all!" By the time I made it to the Commons, I had to fight my way to the front of the cheering mob. The end of the Greenwich Road was lined with British soldiers, relaxed and laughing as their prisoners, captured American soldiers, walked three to a row between the enemies through the doors of the Bridewell prison. "Was there a battle?" I asked a serving girl next to me. "Up the fort," she answered. "Them Hessians killed lots. Blood was running like water, they say. They fired them cannons from the ships. Blue arms and legs everywhere, heads too." I nodded, unable to think what I should say. A chant started in the crowd and singing. I did not join in, nor did I throw clods of mud as many did, including the bloodthirsty girl next to me. The rebels kept coming in, row after filthy row, most with their heads down, some limping with a crutch or an arm in a sling. Their uniforms were torn and tattered. A few walked barefooted over the icy cobblestones, flinching when hit square with mud or a rock. They carried neither flag nor weapons. Their breath billowed like they were hard-ridden horses. It hung around their heads like smoke. He was toward the end of the line with the other enlisted slaves, his head bent forward, his face invisible. A bloody bandage was tied above his right knee, and it looked painful to step with his right foot. The only way I knew him was that hat, nearer brown than red now, with a rip through the brim and the ring in his ear. The guard shoved the last of the prisoners, including the boy with the red-brown hat, through the doors of the prison and closed them with a loud metal clang. Chapter 34, Sunday, November 17th through Sunday, November 24th, 1776.